Radio.
So Star Trek came out 50 years ago. We know that. That is fact, and that is something that you should know if you're listening to this podcast. I'm Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek. Over 50 years ago, Star Trek premiered, and people loved it, and people followed it, and people became fans when they wrote letters to the network and to the actors and to Gene Roddenberry and all these people because they loved the show, because they believed in it. But the reason that I'm here 50 plus years later talking about it is not necessarily because of that original series. No, the reason I'm talking about it is because another anniversary, it happened actually yesterday, and I missed it. Well, I didn't miss it. I sort of missed it. I was at Disneyland. I was at Disneyland yesterday with my family, and today's my wife's anniversary. But I put a pin in it because when I saw it was this anniversary, it was the 35th anniversary of this, I was like, wow, I got to talk about this. You know, I've been pussyfooting around some of the bigger episodes, some of the bigger issues about Star Trek because I wanted to kind of hoard them. But this is episode 60. We have to talk about these things. We have to. And so this is going to be the first of several podcasts, I hope, about this subject. But we have to do it. Because this moment is what I believe created and sustained this franchise. It was that life raft, that life buoy, that life preserver, that's the word I'm looking for, which saved the franchise and gave us all the Star Trek we could eat for the next 35 years. So tonight, I'm not going to talk about the nuts and bolts. I'm not going to talk about the structure of it. I'm not going to talk about the characters, the actors, and that sort of stuff. Tonight, kind of on the cuff, I'm going to tell you about a 13-year-old boy who in 1982 went to see Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan and how it changed the franchise and changed that boy's life. And that boy is me.
Are you insane?
They are insane!
In the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
But Matt Frosting.
It does like you.
Okay, as a bit of clarity, it's not my wife's anniversary. It's my anniversary, our anniversary of being married. So we are celebrating our anniversary tonight, and I'm celebrating the best way I know how by doing a podcast after she's asleep. So that's where you go to. We had a great time at Disney, a lot of fun. Wished that I have made this lament before that Star Trek should be acquired by Disney because we would get very passable, very enjoyable Star Trek product for the next 100 years. Whereas now CBS and Paramount are sort of kind of dancing around trying to figure out what they're trying to do. But I'm also very cognizant of the fact that I can be so picky as to be, I can go ahead and be derisive. Yes, derisive of like the TV show, which hasn't even aired, and of the three movies in the Kelvin universe, I can be dismissive of them and say, oh, they're not what I like. They're not real Star Trek. When in fact, 35 years ago, we might not have had any of this. The last episode I did was City on the Edge of Forever. Great episode. You need to listen to that. I have like two or three which I can say, hey, you really kind of have to listen to that. I think like number 40, The Lonely God is a great one. And this one, number 59, about the City on the Edge of Forever. Those are great ones. Those are ones I actually worked on. The Balance of Terror is a pretty good one too. I don't know if this one's going to be as good, to be honest with you. But it's going to be earnest. Because, you know, as I was thinking about this today, as I was doing my limited amount of prep for this episode, because I kind of got caught unaware of the fact that this was coming up, I realized that it has been 35 years. And that some of you who are listening to this podcast were not alive 35 years ago. God damn it, I hate that. I hate that. I hate being old. I hate it. I don't feel old. And you won't feel old when you're my age. I'm 109 years old. That may or may not be true. You'll figure it out. You've already reverse engineered probably how old I am right now. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because what I want to do right now is I want to take you back to when I was 13 years old and I watched Star Trek II and the excitement I felt. Oh my God. That film changed my life. It also changed the course of this franchise to the point now where there's 700 episodes, there's 14 movies, there's a new series and possibly new movies, and the future, while not completely bright, is at least still possible. There's still a chance for more Star Trek for the rest of our lives, and we get the American privilege of being snooty about what we're being given. Oh, this buffet doesn't have enough crab. Let's go someplace else. I mean, come on. It's all you can eat, and that's what we're getting. It's the second time I've used that analogy. Maybe I'm hungry. No, it's I'm not hungry. But let's dive into this a little bit, all right? Let's figure this out a little bit. Let me tell you how Mike McCafferty felt when he first saw this. Because this podcast is all about what I think, not what you think. Well, that sounds weird, doesn't it? I should edit that out, but I'm not going to. This is just going to be a stream of consciousness, and you're going to be there with me. Because, man, I loved Star Trek when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I can remember Saturday mornings, or Saturday afternoons, actually, it's like 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, watching reruns of Star Trek. Now, again, this is the 1970s, and there wasn't a lot of good science fiction on during midday, whatever. They might show a science fiction movie, maybe a Godzilla movie, something like that. If you're lucky, you get to see Forbidden Planet. Great movie, by the way. If you want to see some of the precursors of Star Trek, Forbidden Planet is a great reference point. In fact, I believe Gene Roddenberry actually used it as sort of a reference point for what Star Trek would become. But you got to see, you know, kind of black and white science fiction or some weird color movie science fiction, maybe some Lost in Space. But Saturday afternoons, they had the original Star Treks on. I would watch that right after Petticoat Junction. Petticoat Junction would come on, and then I'd watch Star Trek. My dad would be sitting on his couch with his little circular ottoman there with his feet propped up and not really paying attention to this, and I watched as Kirk fought the Gorn or the Gamesters of Triskelion. Those are the ones I remember because those are the action-packed ones. As a kid, man, you lived for that stuff. You lived for the part where these bigger-than-life characters were bigger than life, where they're running around and punching or telling jokes or kissing the girls. Come on, man. But still, as a young kid, you loved it. Ship battles and phaser battles and monsters. Man, that was great. But there weren't any more to be made. Once you saw all of them, you saw all of them. There was the animated series, and the animated series was batshit crazy. And to this day, I still don't understand some of the decisions they made. It seemed like everyone at Filmation was completely stoned on whatever they could find and ingest and just made this crazy-ass cartoon, which was 11 minutes too long. You cut that down to 11 minutes or 5 minutes, it's pretty good. 22 minutes, wow, you feel like you're in some sort of time flux. But that's all you had in the 70s. You had to kind of like hang on to that. I had the action figures, the dolls back then. We talked about this in one of the previous podcasts where I had the Kirk doll and maybe I think I had the Uhura doll, maybe the Spock doll. There were those 9-inch dolls, you know, the ones that like had like cloth clothes and they would inimitably fall off or like something would happen where they would get lost and somehow like Spock was shirtless and Kirk had no pants and it seemed like some sort of strange pornography film that you didn't know was going on. It's like, oh, how can you be the captain of the Enterprise if you don't have your shirt or your pants and you only have one boot? That is not right. I'm sorry. That's all you had to go on. Later on with Star Wars action figures, they figured out, hey, why don't we just make the clothes all plastic that's molded to their bodies? And that way we don't have to worry about that. No one will ever lose any clothes again, and it will never be this kind of strange, like, you know, Caligula-like thing. So, here I was, stuck in the 70s with nothing to look forward to. And then along comes something called Star Wars. And as much as I love to talk about Star Trek, I also love Star Wars. For a 9-year-old, I believe that's how old I was, 1977. Yeah, 9 years old. Man, that changed my life. That was amazing. I saw it 9 times. 9 times. Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I saw it 9 times in movie theaters because that was your DVR. That was your DVD. That was your iTunes purchase. You just went back to the theater and saw it. I saw it over and over again. It was so damn good. And Star Trek faded away. I mean, Star Trek was like, yeah, okay, great. But there's no more Star Trek. So my life's all about Star Wars. I fell in love with that. And then based on that came the new Star Trek movie, the motion picture. Like, oh my gosh, this is, oh wow. Star Trek's coming back. Star Trek is coming back. This is so great. I was so excited. I was so excited for the motion picture. But I messed up on the time that it was showing, and I actually came in 5 minutes late. Not that I missed a whole lot. I actually missed the best parts, probably, where the Klingons were firing at the cloud. And, you know, I think I came in halfway through when, like, they were beaming up Zahn and somebody else. And they're like, wah! And they turned into monsters, and they beamed them back. Didn't matter if I'd seen that part. Because what had happened was that the motion picture was baffling to me. As a 11-year-old kid, what was that, 79? I didn't know what the hell was going on there, 10 or 11. It was so confusing. They just sat there on the bridge for an interminable amount of time, looking at a cloud, not even a defined ship, but just some sort of weird, abstract sort of set pieces that they were going in. I don't know what the hell they were in. As I think about it now, the other thing that was also bothersome about this was that it wasn't Kirk's story. Kirk was a passenger, as much as we were on this. Kirk was just sort of floating around in this ship on his bridge, which wasn't even his bridge. It was Decker's bridge, really. Kind of mystified as what was going on. If anybody's story, this was Spock's story. Spock was going through his own midlife crisis, and he needed to come back to the Enterprise to figure out if there was anything to do about that. And with the motion, in the motion picture, V'ger was sort of his answer. This creature that was not one or the other. It wasn't Voyager, and it wasn't this robotic sentient species, which was very much like the plot line for Nomad, or for the Changeling, with Nomad and Tanru getting morphed together. But this was Spock's story. And it was so esoteric and cerebral that it was like, I guess it was okay that he found some degree of happiness. But no one was happy in that show. There's two moments in the motion picture that was actually Star Trek-like. The first one was when Spock beamed aboard and McCoy says, so help me God, I'm actually happy to see you. And I remember everyone in the audience in the theater actually laughed. Like, ah. And then Spock's like this weird, like asshole who's just like, I'm going to go off to the science station. He's like, well, what the hell's wrong with him? And the second part was right at the very end, where V'ger's been destroyed, spoilers, and they're on the ship, and they're like, where should we go? And then Kirk says, out there. And then he kind of leans back, and he kind of waves his hand, says, that away. And that's funny. He's like, ha, ha, oh, this is great. Oh, the film's over? That's it? That's all we get? Two little moments of what Star Trek is? The movie was over, and it had actually started being fun. I'll go into the motion picture in a lot more detail at some other time. But suffice it to say that when I left the theater for Star Trek the Motion Picture, I had no desire to go back and see that one. I had seen Star Wars 9 times. But this, in fact, I might have even seen when they re-released it, like later on that year or something like that. Or maybe it was, I don't know. But I had no desire to see it because it wasn't really Star Trek. And even if it was, I mean, 11 years after the last episode had aired, this was so disappointing. And so I put all my eggs into the Star Wars basket. Empire Strikes Back came out in 1980. And man, I was all in with that one. I saw that one like 5 times, I believe. There was a hotline you could call before the movie came out where you supposedly, like you heard this message from C-3PO. And I tried to call it so many times, but the line was disconnected. So many times I almost cried. I couldn't get through. I was so passionate about that. Actually, I did cry. I did actually cry at one point in time. We had come back from some sort of trip with my dad. My dad, he loved, like, first of all, he had a running magazine. If you look at my body shape right now and say, your father had a running magazine? What happened? Well, I do run on occasion, but not enough, and I eat more food than I should, which is probably why I'm always hungry. I'm always talking about buffets, but that's a whole different story. My dad had a running magazine, and he would take us all over Michigan for, like, running events, for races. They're called races. I know that. Don't worry about that. And we had come back from one of these trips, like, to some distant part of Michigan. Michigan's actually pretty long if you count in the Upper Peninsula. And I'd come back. It was, like, a Sunday night. And I was like, oh, my God, maybe I can call it now. It's Sunday night. And I called it, and it was still disconnected. And I just started to cry because I loved it so much. I so much wanted to see it. And if the thing I can impart upon you on about all of this is that towards the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s, there was so little science fiction. There were so few options for someone to who loved the idea of the future of superheroes in the fantasy world or Dungeons and Dragons, but of science fiction, of space, of dreaming of other worlds. There were so few options. Battlestar Galactica, maybe? Galactica 80? Oh my God. I mean, there were a few movies here and there. You know, there are a couple of TV shows. I mean, Buck Rogers, but they were all campy and terrible. There may be people who didn't really understand science fiction. I mean, Battlestar Galactica was good. Buck Rogers was kind of ridiculous. I may have to go back and do a deep dive on that at some point in time. But what I want to impress upon you is that where we have this glut of science fiction everywhere, every third television show that you turn on is science fiction, every movie that's a blockbuster has some sort of element of science fiction or fantasy. Back in the late 70s, that did not exist. But it was beginning to change. Oh, and I stopped for a second because I realized that, speaking of fantasy and stuff like that, Dungeons and Dragons had just started up with Gary Gygax's Dungeons and Dragons Basic and Advanced Modules and Basic Handbook. And I got into that 100%. Oh my God, it was so great. So even though there wasn't a lot of television and film, those of us who were around during that period of time were starting to fill the void no matter what. But the good news is that the 80s were starting to happen. And once The Empire Strikes Back hit in 1980, things started to change. Because after Star Wars, I think the industry was like, well, let's throw out some films and see if they're any good. See if like, so they throw out some kind of some chaff, some not so great science fiction ideas, not so great movies. But then The Empire Strikes Back came out, and I love that movie. Wow, you want to talk about a movie which just hit you so hard, you know, just the bad guys won? What the hell? I mean, it's in the title, The Empire Strikes Back, but you didn't think that was real. And here they are, they won. Oh my God. And the thing about that movie, about The Empire Strikes Back, is that it had begun to show to the development executives, to the heads of the studios, that you could do an adult-themed science fiction film. I mean, Star Wars is great, but make no mistake, it is targeted towards a younger audience. I mean, it is about young people running around, shooting lasers and waving light swords and defeating evil, and it's a very basic story. It's good versus evil. Empire Strikes Back came around, and it totally changed that by bringing in some gray. What if the bad guy's your father? Spoiler. What happens then? What if the good guys lose? How do you feel about that? What if we end the movie and all is lost? Boy, that's a weird way to stop that. But they had the courage to do it. And because it was so successful, because it made so much money, and then in 1981, Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, and that also blew the doors off of all the whole genre. Suddenly, the studios were a lot more interested in making films of the science fiction, fantasy, superhero genre. Along comes 1982, and I want to read for you. Well, it's been talked about before, but 1982 is one of those seminal years of science fiction and fantasy movies. Listen to listen to the films that came out in 1982. Blade Runner, Tron, The Thing, E.T., Poltergeist. I can go on with a couple more. The Dark Crystal, The Secret of NIMH. These are kind of like off-brand. The Entity, it's a great movie. Beastmaster, I'm just looking at a few of these right here. And tucked in among all of those. I mean, and just listen to that. Blade Runner, Tron, The Thing, E.T., Poltergeist. Those are five movies which have spawned sequels and have changed the way that we look at science fiction. Blade Runner, iconic noir, Tron, the beginning of CGI, The Thing, one of the scariest horror movies of all time, E.T., one of the most charming alien movies of all time. Poltergeist, damn scary, directed by Steven Spielberg. Most people don't know that. He directed it. Trust me on that. And tucked away in all of those was Paramount's chance to grab at some money. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Now, I'll be honest with all these films coming out. I remember seeing Tron. I remember seeing E.T. I remember crying. I cried during E.T. I did. Man, that was so good. So I did not see The Thing in the theaters. Too scary. Did see Blade Runner. Weird. Did see Poltergeist in the theaters. Very scary. And then out comes Star Trek II. Now, as I said before, I was firmly entrenched in the whole Star Wars universe. And so as exciting as all those films were, I was already looking ahead to 1983 with Return of the Jedi. I was so excited about that. Now, I had waited in line for The Empire Strikes Back. My mom pulled me out of school and let me go to see the first screening of The Empire Strikes Back. It rained. I stood in line for 2 hours and it rained. I remember my mom got me tickets for that, and she also bought me the Star Trek role-playing game. Remember I told you about Dungeons & Dragons before? They had just come out with a Star Trek role-playing game like that month, and my mom got me that and got me tickets to see the movie. And I stood there in the rain for 2 hours and I saw The Empire Strikes Back, and it blew me away. So when I tell you that I still loved Star Trek, it was a Star Wars world for me. And Star Trek was, I was looking back to the old Star Trek because I lost faith in the new one. The motion picture had baffled me, had seemed boring. There was nothing exciting about it. So when Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan finally came out, I didn't know what to make of it. And so I was not first in line to see that, to be honest. It might have been like a week when it came out. I can't remember. But I do remember that I wasn't, like, I don't have any sense of being like, oh my God, Wrath of Khan's coming out. No, I was in this middle ground of wanting to play Star Trek, the role-playing game, and talking about, you know, all the cool movies like Tron and Blade Runner, all these cool movies that I'd seen in E.T. I think actually E.T. is coming up. But I wasn't, you know, 100% into this yet. Which explains why I saw it in the least, in an unoptimal theater. Why I didn't go to a great theater. Now, this is the 80s, man. They didn't have great viewing experiences no matter where you went. But for this one, I actually saw it in the Renaissance Center in downtown Detroit. If you've ever seen pictures of Detroit, there's this weird building which has four smaller buildings around it and one kind of glass tower. That's called the Renaissance Center, the Ren-Sen. It was supposed to be the Renaissance of Detroit. That didn't work out so well. Detroit is now bankrupt, and it's gone from 1.5 million in the 1950s to 600,000 people in current time. So the Renaissance Center was almost kind of like this weird tombstone. But at the time, when it was built, it was really cool. In fact, they used the interiors for the movie Buck Rogers. You can go back and see it. It had these cool, weird, like concrete places you could sit that were like on the fifth floor that kind of floated above. It's hard to describe, like these little pods again on these stalks. Man, that does not make any sense. Don't worry about it. Stay with me. My dad had gotten a hotel room there because we were covering another run or something like that. And so me and my sister, we had nothing to do. So my dad got us tickets to a movie. He loved taking us out to movies. He loved going to movies. And he had to go cover this road race. And so we went to go see Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan in the Renaissance Center. In downtown Detroit, in kind of a small theater. It wasn't one of their big theaters, kind of like a smallish theater, maybe like 150 seats, kind of narrow. And so I sat down there with my sister, and the movie began to unspool. The first thing I remember about it is the credits, the opening credits, the music and the space field. And the music was great. It's that James Horner score. I had the album. I listened to it every single day after it came out. So good. I had the cassette tape too, which I put in my Walkman. Welcome to the 1980s, damn it! But the credits, they went on forever and ever and ever. And then we went to the Starship Enterprise with Lieutenant Savick, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And then everything went to hell. Right? And then, like, everyone's dying. And you're like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Now, what I didn't know is that it had leaked out that Spock might die in this. Now, I didn't know that because we didn't have the internet, okay? I read Starlog magazine. That's how I got most of my science fiction news. And so maybe it had leaked out on some sort of like entertainment beat reporter, or maybe in Variety, or maybe going out to the newspapers that, hey, Spock might die. But I wasn't reading that. I was reading Starlog. And I don't remember Starlog like spoiling that. Maybe they kept it to themselves because they wanted an exclusive interview with Walter Koenig or something like that. Because Starlog, if you don't know, was the only magazine about science fiction from like the late 70s until the late 80s. And then lots of other magazines came around. Then the internet came around. Then there were no more magazines. But I was interviewed for it. When I was part of the Invisible Man, I was interviewed for it. So that was kind of a cool thing. But I digress. There was no knowledge to my knowledge that Spock was going to die. But in order to fake everyone out, they made Spock die right off the bat. Be like, ha ha, we fooled you. He's not really dead. But watching that, I didn't know what the hell was going on. Who is this Vulcan girl, and why is she in control, and why are they going to the neutral zone? Why is everyone dying, and why is everything exploding? And then through the light, after the whole simulation, came Captain Kirk. Prayer, Savik. The Klingons don't take prisoners. He's all shadowed up. Lights. Whew. Man, that was cool. Such a dramatic difference from when we saw him before in the motion picture, when he's in these weird spandex kind of casual wear where he has short sleeves. He's got goddamn short sleeves, polyester. What the hell is that? That's not Captain Kirk. No. Now he shows up and he's wearing this monster maroon, as the costumes wear, as Ryan Nagata calls it. But this maroon sort of like, I don't know what the hell. It looks like a suit of armor. This front piece, it's maroon with black pants with a maroon stripe down it and boots. And he's a goddamn badass. And as a 13-year-old, I'm like, oh, this is different. This is not what I've seen before. And I started to go down the rabbit hole with that. They had all sorts of great little nuggets to go on. One of the things that stuck with me all the time was, as they're walking, as Kirk and Spock are walking out of the simulation room, there's a guy vacuuming. And I was looking at that guy, what the hell's going on? There's a guy vacuuming the floor. We had never seen anyone do menial tasks in Star Trek, and yet here was that. That's so weird. Kim Miller, the doctor, does not remember that, and I'm going to give her a grief about that, but that's okay. As the story goes on, we start to see that Captain Kirk, although he is a badass for coming in there's something wrong with him. And as we have that birthday celebration for him in his house, in his weird apartment looking over San Francisco, McCoy points out that he's going through this malaise, that he's bored with his life, that he's going through, hello, a midlife crisis. Now, for a 13-year-old, you didn't quite understand it, but you dug it because you're watching your characters and they're really wrestling with something. Now, Kirk wasn't wrestling with anything. He took the command away from Decker in Star Trek The Motion Picture and didn't really have that much of a problem with it. And Spock was wrestling with the fact that he was going through his own midlife crisis, but because he was so damn Vulcan and because he wasn't the lead of the story, the leads of the story really are Ilia and Decker, to be honest. I mean, that's who the real leads of the motion picture are. we didn't really get a chance to explore his emotional anguish. But here, it was so luxurious to watch characters that we hadn't seen for, you know, almost 15 years struggle with being older. A lot of TV shows, a lot of movies now, when they come back and they reboot, they just try to pick things up exactly what they were, as though nothing's changed. But this sunk its teeth into it, and that's what you wanted to see. And as a 13-year-old who was reading comic books and was starting to become aware and slightly frustrated of the fact that these characters were never going to grow old, were never going to die, they're never going to change as a result of that, or if they did age, it was always very, very slowly, right? I mean, Peter Parker was in high school for about 53 years, and then he went into college and then grad school, and like, oh my God, man, just graduate already. But here we were, 14 years later, and Kirk's older, and he's aware of it. He's an admiral now. He does not like that. And the things that he wants were the things from his youth, the things that we remember him doing. If you take away the motion picture and put it aside, the last thing we saw him do was running, gallivanting around the cosmos in a bright yellow shirt, having fun, shooting phasers, rescuing the universe. And here he is behind a desk now in a muted red suit of armor, trying to figure out what happened, trying to figure out how he became old. And again, you know, from a 13-year-old mind, you can sort of simulate what that's like and not really get it like you can when you're older. But even then, you knew that something had changed and that this was different and the stakes were suddenly so much higher. We'll talk about this later on, but the stakes were higher because this was going to be the last one they're going to make. This was a one-off. This was Paramount trying to do a money grab, saying, hey, we've still got these sets, we've still got these ships. Let's try and do it one more time for a seventh of the budget and see what we get. Maybe we'll make it a movie of the week on TV. Maybe we'll release it. Who knows? So everybody was playing with house money on this. So why not go for it? And boy, do they go for it with the next scene. Now, we're still trying to catch up with everything that's going on here. And after we see Kirk kind of having this sort of midlife kind of lethargy, we immediately are introduced to our complication, which is Khan. And we all remember Khan. If you watch Star Trek, you remember him from Space Seed. He was the guy who was smarter than Kirk, who was stronger than Kirk. And if Kirk hadn't pulled out some weird PVC pipe and beat the shit out of him in the engineering room, Khan would have tossed him out in outer space and be running around the galaxy in a Constitution-class ship. And who knows what would happen from that point in time. Kirk barely escaped and then marooned him on a planet with Marlon MacGyver's, one of his own crew members. And Spock at the end says it'd be interesting to see what would happen in 500 years or whatever he said, 100 years. But it wasn't that long. It was only 14 years, and now we're back. And look what happened to him. It takes a while to catch up. For me, I was like, what's going on here? And then you see Khan, and boy, his reveal is so good because he just pulls off, you know, layer by layer. And it's like he's pulling off the years as he pulls off each scarf. That seems like a weird thing. Every time he pulls off a scarf, a year comes off. He pulls off a scarf. He keeps on one glove, which always seems a little Michael Jackson-y to me. I'm going to say that. He wears one glove throughout most of the film. But he takes his time. Ricardo Montalban, an accomplished actor, Fantasy Island guy, takes his time to reveal himself. And him, along with Alan Rickman, kind of set the stage for a new kind of villain. A villain that is smart, that is confident, that is charming, and is always a couple of steps ahead of our heroes. It puts our heroes in these weird kind of situations of having to play catch-up, having to be smarter than these people, having to rise up to the challenge. He was a new kind of villain, and he also had this great built-in revenge. Now, I'll talk more about that later on. But man, when you saw him, when I saw him, oh boy, it was creepy. And then, holy shit, he put bugs in people's ears. Oh my God. You have probably seen, if you're younger, you've probably seen that scene 1,000 times and you've seen things even more gross. But and certainly Ridley Scott did the chest bursting thing and the face hugger. But he put creatures in our bodies. He put something in their ear. That's not the first orifice that you think about when you think, oh, something crawled inside of me. No, because oh, I've got that eardrum. I'm cool, right? I'm good with the eardrum. Like eyes, okay, I've got the eyeballs, I should be safe. You're always like nose, mouth, lower regions. But the ear, oh my God, that just creeped me out. And I know it creeped out my sister. My sister was like, oh my God, I cannot handle this. She was like 11. So imagine that for like an 11-year-old, you know, person, 11-year-old girl watching that just freaked the shit out of her. So we knew that this film was already serious and that we had a villain. I had a villain that I remembered who was now really, really angry. And you know what? Maybe deservedly so. His argument that Kirk never went back and checked him out, you know, that he's kind of right. He's kind of right. Now, Kirk could have just court-martialed him or thrown him out of the airlock or something like that, but he gave him a chance. But he never checked up on him.
That's kind of on Kirk a little bit. All right. I know this is taking a while, but I want you to experience what I experienced as I was going through this movie. And, you know, one of the things that really stuck out to me, remember I told you in the motion picture, there were two points in time when the movie was actually fun, actually like Star Trek. In this movie, all the moments were pretty much like Star Trek. Yes, it was much more adult, but we were ready for that. We were ready for our characters to grow from the original series. If they had showed up again in those yellow and blue and red outfits and just kind of ran around and act like nothing had happened, we wouldn't have bought into that. But this, they have that age to them, but they're still acting like Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. And I loved the scene where after Kirk shows Spock and McCoy what the Genesis device is, Spock and McCoy bicker. They bicker and they banter, just like they did in the original series. They both present their arguments to Captain Kirk and let him decide. McCoy is absolutely convinced that this Genesis device will destroy the universe. And Spock's like, dude, man, you gotta chill out. And they kind of leave it at Kirk's doorstep to figure out what to do about that. Now, in this movie, he doesn't really have a choice because he is interrupted by Khan showing up. And let me tell you, when Khan did show up finally, and they finally met each other in space, which is very cold, this 13-year-old melted to a pile of excitable goo on that seat because that was the best goddamn thing I'd ever seen. Yes, the Star Wars trench fight was amazing and exciting because all these little ships are flying around this giant ship that's really, really cool. And in the second movie, in The Empire Strikes Back, when they had the AT-ATs fighting with the little snow speeders, that's really cool too. But this was something we hadn't seen before. Now, in all the episodes of the original series, they fought other ships and they had damage to their ship. But you know what? We never saw it. We heard about it from Spock or Uhura or Scotty or Chekov or Sulu talking about the amount of damage to the shields and the hull and there's injuries coming in. But we never saw it because those models were expensive. And you can't damage that model. You damage that model in the original series. And man, what are you going to do? So when Khan finally locks those phasers on and fires them at the Enterprise, and they hit, and they just gurgle all over the ship, and the energy kind of spews all over it. Yes, that sounds weird and sexual, but it just rips a hole in the side of the ship. I can see it right now. And then we cut into the engineering section, and people are just, there's shit exploding and smoke and stuff. Now, in the old series, when the ship got hit, everyone just kind of like ran to one side and ran to the other side as the camera tilted. But this was explosion and lights and lasers on the outside. This is a real battle. It was, and exactly what they wanted, was like two old sailing ships with their guns pointing at each other, just taking shots at each other and blowing holes in the sides of their ships. And man, you could feel it. As I said before, in the Star Wars movies, we had sort of small ship combat going back and forth, but these were two giant ships exchanging blows, and you could feel every single hit. In Star Wars, when one of the X-Wings or the TIE Fighters got hit, boom, they're gone. That's the end. That's the end of that ship's story. But here, every blow that was traded, you felt, and you saw inside. You saw the destruction. And oh my God, Khan just devastated the Enterprise. And that was amazing. And that is sort of your Empire Strikes Back moment where like, oh my God, the bad guys just won. And as exciting as that was for me at the time, and here I am reeling watching as they're listing off all the damage to the ship, and then Khan shows up, and Khan has got all the cards. He's like, you're gonna beam yourself over and the Genesis thing. Boom, game over. And then I'm going to probably destroy your ship anyways because that's who I am. And Kirk, with only like 60 seconds, although it's a really long 60 seconds, I got to be honest with you, I've timed it a couple times. Khan gives him 60 seconds, but Kirk outsmarts him. And that was so sweet. He comes up with a way to stall Khan and come up with a prefix code, kind of a back door. And then when he lays into him, he's like, time's up. William Shatner does the best acting, the second best acting of his career when he says, here it comes. And you'll hear a lot of different stories about how Harve Bennett basically directed him down. Just calmer. From, I'm sure Shatner was like, here it comes, to here it comes. Now, it was so good. And then they got to punch back at him. And I remember watching Rocky IV. I watched Rocky IV, and it was so stupid. But man, when Rocky, after getting his ass kicked so long by Drago, finally punches back, the whole audience stood up and cheered. And even I was like, yes, get him back. And after getting his ass handed to him by Khan, the fact that Kirk can outsmart him and give back a little bit, oh, it was so satisfying. And the fact, just the look on Khan's face when the shields are going down. Where's the override? With like a thousand little chicklets there, little light brights over there. He couldn't figure it out. And he had to retreat. And Kirk did it. But he still paid a price. And that's going to be reflected back later on. But what a cool scene for a 13-year-old to watch. Oh my God. If the movie would stop right then and they said like, okay, that's the end of the movie. It was like, you know, You've got my money. You take it. I'll pay double to see that again. I'll pay triple. I don't care. It was so cool. But then the movie goes on. And we get to see more of Kirk's errors in life. I mean, first of all, he screws up by having Scotty's son, you know, or nephew getting, you know, killed because he stayed at his post. So already Kirk's kind of in the hole for that. And then what does he do? He has to go and meet Carol Marcus. Oh, my God. Oh, Carol, yeah. How's David? Oh, God, that is David. His son. My son. Who's, Meredith Buttrick is, you know, a great guy, great in square pegs, but a little whiny. A little whiny. We get this whole Genesis scene where they're trapped, buried alive. And then we have the one meta funny moment of this whole movie is when William Shatner screams Khan, which then echoes outside of the planet for some reason as Ricardo Montalban sort of leans back in the chair somewhat orgasmically. It's kind of a weird situation, but that is the iconic moment. You'll see memes about it, of, you know, Kirk shouting Khan into his, you know, his wrist communicator. But the reason they had to do that is to set up the second time that Kirk is super suave and smart. When he talks in code to Mr. Spock, because they're sitting there on this planet and Kirk, he's going lower and lower and lower. Okay, so Scotty's son's dead. The ship is destroyed. You know, it's in such bad shape. My ex-girlfriend's here with this son who hates me. There's a madman up there. And then I just have to tell Savick that I cheated on the Kobayashi Maru. I have to kind of admit that and then kind of spin it to like, oh, well, I changed the conditions. It was kind of funny. And then he says, I don't like to lose. And he pulls out his communicator and he reveals that he was talking in code to Spock. He's eating a goddamn apple as he's doing that. He is so James Bond right there. It is amazing. And then that's when we get our kind of wind in our sails right there. That is kind of the all is lost moment. So I'm learning how to write now. And I know that there's this all is lost moment for our characters. And that was it. He was at the lowest he could be. And he admitted things to Carol Marcus. And he admitted things to these people that he had sort of cheated. He cheated death. Never faced a no-win scenario. But it didn't matter because he's James Tiberius Kirk. And damn it, he always has a way out. He's always that smooth, and he pulls out his communicator. Spock, has been 2 hours. Are you ready? Right on time, Admiral. All right. Don't like to lose. Now, at this point in time, I was totally hooked, but I wasn't prepared for what was coming up. Now, there's the Mutara Nebula battle, which is pretty good. You know, there's... I would say, honestly, that the third act battle is not as good as the first act battle or the second act kind of reveal that Kirk has outsmarted Khan a second time. And basically they kind of like float around through the Mutara Nebula and sort of trade blows, and then Kirk comes up with one more, you know, smart thing, which is that he kind of like, you know, goes underneath him and then comes back up. This is all fine. It was all very, very nice. But it was definitely kind of a murkier third act. But all that could not prepare me for what was about to come up. As I had said a little earlier, is that everyone in this film was playing with house money. They were going for broke. There was nothing left to hold back. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that this was going to be the last film they were going to make. Here I was, 13 years old. I haven't even read that Spock was supposed to, you know, to die. So I had no idea what was coming up. But then the circumstances started to present themselves. And all of a sudden, the Enterprise is badly damaged. And all of a sudden, Khan activates the Genesis device and they can't get away. And Scotty has this radiation leak and he can't fix it. And then all of a sudden, Spock goes down and like, okay. And he goes into the radiation chamber. Wait, what's happening? And then he fixes it. And then bless you, Scotty, go. It says nominal and they take off and the ship explodes. And they got away. They got away, right? I mean, everything's okay. Everybody's fine. But they weren't. And McCoy says, Jim, you better get down here. Better hurry. And he looks and Kirk sees that Spock is away from his chair. And he runs down there and, you know, Spock was, he has all this radiation burns all over his face. And you can tell that things are not going well. And as a 13-year-old, I could tell that things were not going well. And when Sky says he's dead already, he was just slumped over there, and then Kirk calls out to him, and he gets up. And you're like, okay, he's okay. And then he bumps in the wall, and it's a little bit funny. People laugh for a minute. People laugh because they're uncomfortable. But they have this exchange between the two of them, and my little preteen mind is reminded of what Spock said before, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. And this was a sacrifice. And they... these best friends, they're separated by this glass wall. They can't even embrace one last time. They can't even shake hands or hug or do anything like that. And Spock makes this selfless act. And then he slumps down and he dies. And Kirk slumps down. And we pull back. And I didn't know what was going on. Spock dies? No. Spock never dies. Our characters never die. They're like comic book characters. They come back, right? I mean, there's going to be something. He's going to have a vestigial eyelid. He's going to have a second heart. Something's going to happen. There's going to be there wasn't a triac compound. There's a neural paralyzer. There's something. And then we cut to the funeral scene. And I said earlier that William Shatner gives the performance, the second best performance of his life, when he says, "Here it comes." And his first best performance is when he gives his eulogy for his friend. "Of all the souls I've encountered in my travels, the souls, not souls. His was the most. And he could barely say it. Human." And then they play Amazing Grace, and the pod goes out. Everyone's crying, even Savick. And you know who else was crying? I was crying. This 13-year-old boy who's trying to learn how to be a tough man, who's trying to figure out how to become an adult in this world, is suddenly handed the death of one of his favorite characters. A character who maybe he didn't realize how much he cared about, because the first movie kind of reduced the value of the series. But all of a sudden, this character's gone. He's being shot out of the ship. And tears were just streaming down my cheeks. And my sister's as well. What had they done? Why had they taken us on this beautiful ride? This having so much fun, and it's everything I'd ever wanted. And then they took away a third of the big three. I mean, why would they do that? It was so hard on me. And the scenes after, where Kirk is starting to find his purpose again. Well, you know, I mean, that's fine. And when they're all standing there watching the sun kind of crest over the new planet, the new Genesis planet, I mean, I guess I felt a little bit better. But oh my God, like those 4 minutes or so between Spock dying and the very end of the film, I was just inconsolable. And I probably would have been crying up till now. I mean, it was that powerful on me. I mean, it's even making me tear up a little bit. This is the second time in, you know, two episodes I'm actually getting a little teary-eyed. But had they not added in that scene where you saw the photon torpedo tube resting there on the Genesis planet, and oh my God, how I wish they would have just had him pop out and said, "I'm okay, everybody. See you next time." But they didn't. And because we didn't know what was going to happen in 1982 to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, to the Star Trek franchise, we didn't know that 35 years later we'd be looking at an additional 600 episodes, another, 11 more films, 12 more films. That could have been it. And as great as that film was, it ripped my heart out. Oh, so much. So much. For a 13-year-old to go through. I have a 13-year-old right now. My son, Karenin. And I can't bear... I don't know what his Wrath of Khan will be. I don't know if he'll get a film that could do all those things. That could bring back your younger characters and then kill them off. And one of the reasons I don't know if they'll ever do that again is... And, you know, I'm thinking right now they did that in... spoiler... If you haven't seen Guardians of the Galaxy 2, they do that with a minor character, with Yondu, and like, you know, it's obvious Star Trek 2 reference. But I don't know if they'll ever be able to pull something off like that, because they brought Spock back. And so death in movies is not necessarily permanent. Same thing with Fast and Furious and Michelle Rodriguez, which is completely weird. But at that time, in 1982... the franchise was over because Mr. Spock was dead. That film, as I said, had a profound effect on me. And most of what I do now through Star Trek is referenced not only through the original series, but also through Star Trek II. To me, if you ask me what my favorite film is of all time, I'll still go back to Star Trek II. The depth and the layers of that film. I mean, we haven't talked about him dealing with growing old that much. We haven't talked about the needs of many versus the needs of the few or the one. You know, we haven't talked about revenge as a narrative. We haven't talked about the kind of not necessarily fully realized idea of a bunch of cadets on the ship trying to pull it together. We will look at all that stuff, at least, you know, soon. And in a couple weeks, depending on when you listen to this, I'm going to go to the 35th anniversary screening of it, where Nicholas Meyer and Nichelle Nichols will be there for a Q&A afterwards at the Chinese Theater. I was there 10 years ago at the Egyptian Theater when they had the 25th anniversary of it. And they had George Takei, and I think they had Walter Koenig. I can't remember who else they had there. And if they have a 45th and a 50th, I'll probably try to be there too. Because it was that important of a movie to me, and I think it's that important of a movie to the franchise. Well, it absolutely is, because that film made a ton of money. And then because of that, the outcry to find Spock made them create a film called The Search for Spock, where they found him. Spoiler. And then they made a movie about saving whales, and it worked. And while they're making another movie directed by William Shatner, they actually made another TV series. And that was hugely successful. And they made another series, and another series, and another series. And meanwhile, they were making more movies with the original cast and the Next Generation cast. And now they're making another TV series, and they're making more movies. And on and on and on it goes. This franchise will never stop. And one of the big reasons is because 35 years ago, everyone who was associated with that film did everything they could to make 13-year-old boys and girls remember why they loved the series in the first place. And 35 years later, some of them are still talking about it. ¶¶ Wow, I didn't expect to have all those emotions come forward in reliving that. All the excitement, all the joy, all the passion, all the sorrow of it. I got choked up again, just like I did in the last episode I did about Star Trek. But it's good. And I'm glad you got to join in this remembrance with me. And I hope you tune in next time. Because I'm Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pay in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.